Well, I'd like to welcome everybody here. We're very fortunate, and I'm very happy to welcome Professor Galtung to the LSE. I feel really privileged to be introducing him. I've known him for 30 years, and when I first knew him, he was already the guru of peace research. So he's managed to sustain that position as the dominant figure in peace research over a period of 30 years. And so many ideas, which I think now we talk about and we take for granted, like structural violence, positive peace, to name just but a few, have come from Johan. He's also, as you will hear, a wonderful speaker and speaks the most enormous number of languages. I'm not quite sure how many, all extremely fluently. And so I'm really looking forward to hearing what his take is on the post-September the 11th event. So without any more ado, I will hand over to Johan, who's going to speak from here because he has some slides to show. He's not going to speak from the lectern.
Thank you so much, Mary. Such a pleasure to be at LSE again and to be introduced by my dear friend who has made such marvelous contributions to the field. What I'm going to talk about is the tragedy that we are all wrapped into. And I'm going to try to show that there are three different approaches, out of which two are pathological and one is sane. It so happens that I represent the third approach, just for your information. And if you find that by saying so, it's a little bit unfair distribution of the qualifying adjectives, you just have to listen to what I have to say, and you will sooner or later agree with me. Now, this is the technique used to preserve guruhood for 30 years, and I'm in excellent shape physically, so you can expect it to go on still for some time. Having said this, I would like to introduce the topic with four very strong movements in the West: anti-Judaism, anti-Islam, anti-communism, and anti-terrorism. And I would like sort of speak heuristically to ask the question, what's behind these movements? And I would like to suggest one thing. What is behind them is that Jews, Muslim, communists, and let's call them terrorists, had a message. And that was a highly inconvenient message. And everything is then done to eliminate the bad messengers. And this is done by developing strong prejudices, hatred, violence, genocide, the kind of thing that's going on now, moving in to kill. But all of it has one thing in common, namely not to listen to their message. You can say with St. John, chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning was the Word. And all four of them spoke the Word. And let me now try to say what they said. The Jews said, your Jesus is fake. He's not the Messiah. It's a strong message. And it's not a very popular message if you build Christianity around Jesus as the Christ. You may wonder whether there couldn't have been a compromise on that one. Sort of one and a half coming or something like that. And you might bargain a little bit, 1.6, 1.4. See, fascinating possibility. London School of Economics should be good at that kind of thing, finding an equilibrium solution. The message of Islam went one notch higher. Your God is not the only one. It's another one. As a matter of fact, a real one. Now, that didn't go down very well either, to put it mildly. The communists had a message which went very well with LSE at a certain stage, but at some other stage didn't go so well. Your capitalism is fake as Jesus and your God. The question then is, what was the message of September 11? Well, at that point, I usually say that I left behind a message. But it was written in a somewhat peculiar language. They didn't use letters, they used buildings. They wrote the message in the chosen buildings. So let us now see how that message is understood by William Bennett, the leader of Americans for Victory Over Terrorism, Abbott, in a full page edit in New York Times. The radical Islamists who attacked us did so because of our democratic ideals, our belief in and practice of liberty and equality. Abbott will take to task those who blame America first and who do not understand and who are unwilling to defend our fundamental principles. It's not what they did. If this is what they did, having a free choice of buildings where to ram in the planes, in their brutal, absolutely, totally unacceptable exercise of violence. They would have hit the Congress, the White House. They would have hit icons and symbols of American culture, civilization. Could have been the Arlington Cemetery, could have been the Lincoln Memorial, could have been the mall in Washington. There are many choices. They didn't choose that. They chose exactly what they chose, and what they chose was key symbols of American capitalism and American militarism. Now, if William Bennett wants to identify capitalism and militarism with democratic ideals and our belief in and practice of liberty and equality, I leave that to him. I think it's a poor choice, even on his part, to do it. They chose that. So now what's the hidden message? Your globalization is fake. Limits to your universalism. If you want to globalize yourselves. We are not accepting your trade pattern, we are not accepting your military effort to uphold it. Now this gains considerable depth when you know who did it, and I'm returning to that later. Let us first just say that there was a message, and that everything will be done by the Western world to conceal the message, just the way they did for the Jews, for the Muslims, for, let's call them, the communists. Just the way they did. They will not countenance the debate and the challenge. They will twist and turn it around and find some other way of looking at it. What did they do with the Jews? Well, the first thing they did was the idea, the analytical idea, that the point about anti-Judaism is not that one is afraid of anything they said, but they killed Jesus. Well, let's say they did that, that Pontius Pilate gave them a choice, and let's say they voted in favor of killing Jesus. If they hadn't done that, they wouldn't have fulfilled their roles in the Christian dramaturgy. That was their task, to do it. If they hadn't done it, there wouldn't have been any Christianity. Because God was fulfilling, if you will, the word in earlier parts of the Bible of the sacrifice of the Son. Now, the same applies to Islam. Everything will be said about Jews and said about Islam, and they will mobilize an army of social psychologists and Islamic specialists, themselves fundamentalists of kinds, to try to go into any kind of aspect except their message. That is being done now with terrorists. So let us now then just simply have a little look for background information of U.S. state terrorism. And let us start with a simple definition. I have no objection to the definition that terrorism is brutal violence against civilians to spread terror, panic, for a political purpose. I would only add that the authors are sometimes without uniform and sometimes in uniform. When they are in uniform, I would perhaps say state terrorism. It's operating exactly the same way. It's a long time ago that war was only between military, who in a sense by their contract is bound to engage in that kind of exercise. That's a long time ago, long time past. You had to go, I would say, before 1914 to come into that period. That in terrorism you will mobilize bandits, criminals of all kinds, for all kinds of purposes, including private benefit of economic kinds, no doubt about it. That also goes for regular wars. But let us, just as a background, have a short look at the 67 U.S. military interventions since 1945. So if you could start with the first slide that we have already, 1945, it's taken from William Bloom's The Rogue State, an introduction to the world's only superpower, and partly informed by Zoltan Grossman's list of the same. So what you see here is then a division of interventions in general. Second column is for bombings, the third for assassinations of political leaders abroad, and maybe also at home, and the fourth is for perverted elections, maybe also at home. If you now look at it through time from 1890 and you calculate the number of military interventions per year, there is a clear increase. It was 1.15 up to the Second World War, 1.29 after the Second World War, after the end of the Cold War, 2.0. In other words, a very clear increase. But what this diagram is about the spatial distribution. And that's where we come to God and Allah again. You can say there are three phases in U.S. interventionism after 1945. And since surprisingly few people talk about it, I'll try to encapsulate it in a couple of minutes. The first phase was EA for East Asia. It started, of all places, in 1948, essentially, in Jeju Island, south of South Korea. But that's a long, complicated story. It went on in many, many ways, Korea and Vietnam. In 1980 was a post-Korean War incident. 2,000 high school students and university students killed by a brutal division in Gwangju, in the Chola province, where Kim Dae-jung comes from. And the principal author of that crime was the Undersecretary of State in State Department for East Asia at the time, Mr. Holbrooke. Mr. Holbrooke's crime in East Asia is not known because of the Eurocentrism of Western Europe, just as his activity in Western Europe is not known in East Asia. But this is just to indicate that phase one went on for some time. But it was overshadowed in the 1970s and early 80s by stage two, Latin America. The methodology switched from bombing to a large extent, killing, torture, assassinations, developing the instruments by helping the locals to do it, and so on. It touched, practically speaking, all Latin American countries, some more, some less. It led to the other 11 September, 1973, where there was also a very clear message in the buildings chosen, La Moneda, the residence of the president in a democratic country. Evidently, somebody had something against democracy, which is the reason why that 11 September, the major symbol of democracy in Chile was hit. Allende was chosen in as democratic elections as you can get them. It was confirmed by the elections the same year in Curicó, and he was killed. So William Bennett, would you please use that Article 2 in your statement on yourself? Now, if we move on, we come to the third stage. The third stage started with Palestine, started with Iran, started with CIA in the streets of Tehran. But it started culminating in the late 1980s, West Asia. In July 1988, I predicted that there will be a gruesome retaliation. And my prediction was based on what happened in July 1988. Saddam Hussein had been shooting at an American ship when he decided that he was no longer obeying that master. And the US ship didn't want to reveal that they had a conflict with the country they had used. Whereupon they shot down the Iran Air passenger flight 390 from Tehran heading for a Western European country. The number killed was astounding. And I remember myself using the expression that Father Bush, Papa Bush used to use, this is not going to stand. Well, that was one event. The point about it is that West Asia was now addressed for full. And it went on and on. Latin America was slow in dying out. And you can now ask a question, how many were killed in all of this? Low estimate, 12 million. 6 million by overt action by the Pentagon, 6 million by covert action by the CIA. These figures I can defend, but I say they are low estimates. If you have 12 million people killed, and you have an average of 10 bereaved per person killed, that gives you 120 million. And the number of bereaved is more important than the number killed from one point of view, namely future history. That out of 120 million, a handful will get the idea of revenge, I would consider relatively reasonable as an hypothesis. Being a social scientist, I would entertain that as a reasonable hypothesis. And yet they would ask the question, why did they get away with it in East Asia and Latin America? And I'll try to answer that question. And here I am on uneasy, insecure ground because it is not that obvious. But I'll try a cultural, religious explanation. East Asia has Buddhism in common. Buddhism has a basic figure, the karma of a relationship. When the karma has gone bad, as evidenced by a war, the approach is not retaliation, but to improve the karma. Don't necessarily call it reconciliation, but to do things to improve it. In other words, if something is bad in a relation, work on that relation. I could use another term for that. I could call it common sense. Sounds to me relatively reasonable. After the Korean War, after the Vietnam War, an enormous amount of friendliness emerged from South Korea and Vietnam. Why not from whole of Korea? It is latently there, but North Korea was treated very differently. Very, very differently, and North Korea also treated others differently. I leave that aside. I see it as a basic root of explanation. Now, how do you explain Latin America? Why didn't they band together and mobilize a hit back? They could do it, for instance, at the place that I think, just as an hypothesis, as a guess, was the target of the plane that went down in Pennsylvania. So here's my guess. It was headed for Langley, Virginia, for CIA. The building is not tall. The compound is efficient. They were the authors of as much killing as the Pentagon. Now, there have been some explosions outside, but nothing. And here's my effort to explain. Latin America is a Christian country. U.S. is a Christian country. There's a Christian tradition that God sees with maximum benevolence at the most powerful, at the strongest Christian country. That God has a tendency to pick as his servant the strong. When God, in the shape of the Pope, the 4th of May, 1493, issued the document that ushered in Western colonialism and imperialism, the papal bull, which has the slightly bureaucratic title Interquetra, among other things. What the Pope, the Spanish Pope Alexander VI, did was to give jurisdiction of all kinds to the Spanish kings to administer all the new countries and islands that had been discovered and to be discovered. Why did he do that? Well, because Spain was the strongest country in Christianity. But that also means that when the strongest country in Christianity speaks, many people will hear the voice of God. I think Washington is counting on that. And I think it works to some extent. I gave exactly this talk in Managua for a group of Sandinistas and Contras 1 week ago. And there was some little uneasiness about the atheist Sandinistas. And my point was that the more atheist you are, the more believer are you. And your belief will tend to aggregate around the pole that is around you. And you may not be totally aware of its roots. No objection. We go to West Asia. It is Arab Muslim. There are 1.3 billion Muslims in the world, 22 Arabic countries, when you count Palestine. as you should. Allah is not a province, a remote, if you will, nephew of God. Allah is in his own right. The Muslims are not accountable to the Christian God. Nor does Islam have much of the karmic philosophy that I mentioned in Buddhism. Every act of violence launched upon that part of the world reaped a different harvest. That harvest culminated in 11 September. So having said that, we move to the final slide, and that's the one that will stay there for some time. And here are the three approaches to the phenomenon. And you can eliminate the top lines, that's only propaganda. And here we go. I'll start with the column to the right, and it's called the other side. And I assume it to be Islamic. And I'll try to interpret it. And I'll try to say what I think it is. And I'm trying to reject it. It is certainly terrorism in methodology. Not the slightest doubt about that. But why? I think they conceive of themselves as the sword of Allah exercising justice. To quote George Bush, I think they are bringing justice to America. I think it is an act beyond retaliation. It's an act of serving, meeting out justice. I don't think I would see it as instrumental in terms of well-calculated effects. I don't think it's necessarily a means to an end. It could be an end in its own right, exactly interpreted the way I mentioned. It's not a very helpful perspective, and I'd like to give you another example of it. The nuclear bombs that were dropped over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I do not accept that they were dropped in order to save GI lives, in order to make an invasion of Honshu unnecessary. The war was won already. Japan had capitulated. There were only some small things to straighten out. I think it was an act of punishment, bringing justice to the Japanese for having encroached on sacred land, namely land owned, according to them, by God's own servants on earth. Colin Powell said in 1994, in August, when he was still a possible presidential candidate, that God created America in order to bring law and order to the world. That's a heavy burden when you are in that sense. So you can say that US is chosen by God and UK is chosen by US. It's not quite the same, but it is close. Especially when you have a professional evangelist as prime minister. Now, having said that, I'm not going to deal so much more with that column. I'm quite willing to say it's extremist fundamentalist. I think it ranks with 200 British punishment expeditions in the colonies. They were there to show you where justice comes from and where it is located. But the terrorists have a theory. And that theory, as far as I can understand, having dialogues with people very close to them, runs about as follows. It's very well known, and it was the same theory that was entertained by Germany's RAF, Rote Armee Fraktion, the Baader-Meinhof gang. And the theory has two parts. Point one, when we engage in terrorism, the state will show its true character, which is repression. Point two, when the state starts repressing, there will be a revolt against it. Now, the German state showed some repressive characteristics, but there was no revolt against the German state. As a matter of fact, there was contempt, fear, a revolt against the Baader-Meinhof. They were the ones who were rejected. It is very true that the US is engaging in suppression. And I can give you a list taken from a minister in California who has made such a list and trying to express it in terms of amendments. How can we justify, in effect, cancelling the First Amendment and the right of free speech, the right to peaceably assemble? How can we justify, in effect, cancelling the Fourth Amendment, probable cause, the prohibition against unreasonable search and seizure? How can we justify, in effect, cancelling the Fifth Amendment, nullifying due process and allowing for indefinite incarceration without a trial? How can we justify cancelling the Sixth Amendment, the right to prompt and public trial? How can we justify cancelling the Eighth Amendment, which protects against cruel and unusual punishment? These are good questions. In a certain sense, the first hypothesis is confirmed, but not the second. The American revolt is not against the U.S. government. It's against the terrorists. Highly understandable. And the Pentagon knows this because they had a study made right after 1945 on the effects of bombing in Germany and Japan. They had been killing in the millions. Some of the bombing story you can read on that sheet and other speech of mine which has been distributed. And the point about it is that people certainly revolted, namely against American bombing. And it required extreme diplomacy and very much cleverness on the U.S. side to turn that around. I'm not going into how that happened. I'm just saying that this hypothesis by the terrorists is wrong. It's a very dangerous hypothesis. But it's found. They know they're few. They know they're weak. It's called the weapon of the weak. But they think that there is an amplifying factor by the people rising. However, I'll come to it a little bit later and indicate that there may be a little nucleus of truth in it, nonetheless. Let's go to the first column, the second approach, the state terrorism approach. The US-UK are the principal countries. They got NATO allies, they got UN support up to a certain point. They got all governmental organizations and governments they can get for a very simple reason. Terrorism is usually against governments. Any trade union or governments will not like it. Seems to me totally reasonable. The US confuses that with being 100% in favor of US action. It's where they go wrong. And that's where the revolt is already starting. There's a very tiny little effort in the UK, two members of the cabinet having qualms. The only interesting thing about it is that you cannot read it in Washington Post and you don't hear about it on CNN. I happen to live there right now. Came as a surprise when I landed yesterday at Heathrow. Because if you have a unified alliance, you're not going to show the cracks because it might give some people ideas. Now, it so happened that the state terrorists have exactly the same hypothesis. Namely, that if we bomb civilians and kill civilians like we did in Yugoslavia, then people will say, who's responsible for the fact that the electricity doesn't work, that the hospitals have been bombed, that the schools don't function, the infrastructure is out? That's Slobodan Milosevic. Hence they turn against him. It turned out that they turned against the US and to some extent UK. But UK is a little bit hiding in the skirts of the US. That's the idea of being the second chosen, you see? Second chosen and not directly chosen. So you can keep your chosenness and at the same time keep a little bit hidden. It's called politics, it's called statesmanship. It's also called the UK doesn't have any permanent friends, doesn't have any permanent enemies, it has permanent interests. Lord Palmerston, 1837 in the Parliament. Now if you go on from here now, you can ask, where does this bring us? BBC said there were 60 countries on the hit list of the USA. And you hit wherever you find or think you can find Al-Qaeda, and you hit and hit and hit, and you tell people there is no quick ending to this, this will go on possibly for years. It could, as a matter of fact, go on for 100 years with nuclear aspects to it. It has all the characteristics of the Roman Empire towards the end, hitting out wildly with a deficit of analysis and rationality towards the end. I'm talking now about the 450s, the 440s. It ended in 476. This is called the Bas-Empire, the Western Roman Empire. But that's, in a sense, the interesting one right now. It's a basis of comparison. What will be the analytical focus of Approach 1 and 2? Approach 1 will focus on Christianity, but more on the West and particularly on the U.S. They will have very explicit words about the U.S. Approach 2 will focus on Islam and fundamentalism. And you can become, if you are a professor of Islamic studies, you have a heyday right now. So keep it. Or rather, I would say, write your books quickly, because it may not last forever. If I now should say what unites these two, it's of course fundamentalism. The fundamentalism of the Islamic part can to some extent, be identified with Wahhabism. And Wahhabism, of course, came from 18th century Saudi Arabia, as we call it today. And it had recently four incarnations: the royal house, the Saudi Arabian public, the Talibans, and Bin Laden. Now, US is against two of them, in favor of one of them, ambivalent on the Arabian population. Why? Well, one basic difference is who has oil and who doesn't. But I'll not try to reduce it to that. I'll not try to go into economistic reductionism. I would rather try to focus just a little bit more on the word fundamentalism. Here's my definition of fundamentalism. It is dualism plus Manichaeism plus Armageddon. Dualism means the world consists of two parts. You may call them believers and infidels, or you may say you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. But it's a very nice dichotomy. Tertium non datur, there is no third alternative. Manichaeism means that one is good and one is evil. And the word evil will reach a very high frequency from the beginning. There's even an axis. And there is even a joke on the internet about countries that were snubbed and not included in the axis, the club of just as evil countries, even more evil countries, nearly as evil countries, and things of that kind. Now, having listened to that, they expanded it to seven countries in order to be more democratic and more distributive. I haven't come to that. DMA is carrying the fundamentalism, and it has exactly the same formula in fundamentalist Islam and fundamentalist what? I think they came from you. They came from East Anglia. They were Puritans, select. You pushed them into the Netherlands. Maybe that was an act of wisdom. Many of them had degrees of theology from Cambridge University, close to East Anglia. They were learned people, the ones who went on the Mayflower in 1620. On board, they had two gurus, Reverend Cotton Mather and John Winthrop the First. And their basic doctrine was there being no Canaan, no Zion at the end of the Mediterranean, the Jews have forfeited their claim. The one that you find in Genesis 15-17, about the chosen people and the promised land. So we are the new Israelis, and ahead of us is the new promised land. They stole somebody else's metaphor. And when you steal something from somebody, you have to hate them, because you have to give reasons to yourself why you stole it. So the initial inclination was 100% anti-Semitic. Now, they practiced this 4 days after arrival. They destroyed the first native tombs, and they went on. And they became, if you will, the chief ideologues of what became later the United States of America, whose real founder, in my view, is John Winthrop the First. He came from you people. Came from you. Coming back again. East Anglia. They settled in the northern part, in Boston. In 1635, they founded a theological school called Harvard. And from that place on, they issued messages that increasingly became secularized and finally sort of were concentrated in the Kennedy School of Government. But you can say that the essence of the message is about the same. Now, Southern Baptism is a vulgar version of this. You would expect fundamentalists to exercise capital punishment easily because they are the masters of life and death. And that's because God is behind them and God is the master. You will find executions in Wahhabite Arabia, and a chief executioner in Texas became the president of the country. You will find the concatenation of this fundamentalism to the point that you can almost talk about George bin Laden and Osama Bush. I know a little bit about this thing since it's a field of research for the last 25 years, and I'll be at their disposal for writing the scripts if they want it. If they don't want my script, they can just borrow from each other and exchange some words. We are in a very, very bad situation, landed in the claws between two fundamentalists, drawn from the Abrahamic religions. And Christianity and Islam differ from Judaism in having universalistic claims, which Judaism does not have. The Holy Land evidently being too good to share with the Goyim, for which reason you don't universalize. I must admit myself, first time I was in Israel, I looked at all those barren hills with stones, saying that this is not my vision of the chosen land. I prefer Norway and our fjords. But if you want to stick to those hills and stones, it's your problem, not mine. A little bit cynical, but anyhow. I go to the third column. The third column has a very simple Buddhist sociological reciprocity point of departure. Who were the authors of it? Okay, let's accept that there were 19 Arabs, 15 from Saudi Arabia. I would then assume that there is a problem between Saudi Arabia and US capitalism and militarism. I would start at that point. If there is violence in a marital couple, where it is wife beating, husband poisoning, wife killing, you can of course engage in a theory about men in general or women in general. But it's not a bad idea to find out what happened in that marriage the day before. So what happened in that relation the day before? We have to do it. And I myself must say, intellectually, I find it unashamedly stupid not to do that analysis. In no way will I reduce it to it. But it does matter that Bin Laden said, you are now suffering the same humiliation as we suffered more than 80 years ago. You then take your 2001 and you subtract 80 and you come to 1921, but then you had to add plus alpha because he said more than. You came to 1916, Sykes-Picot. I had a pre-trial interview with BBC for a major interview, and the pre-trial interviewer, when I came to Sykes-Picot, she said, what is that? Now, I find that shocking. I find it absolutely shocking, so I react professorially and said, you have an excellent book in your country called Encyclopedia Britannica. Why not go back to that one and call me back after that? Now, she said she didn't have time. Why don't you just tell me? So I told her. Sykes was British foreign minister, French. Picot was French foreign minister. They had promised the Arabs that if they rise up against the Ottomans who were allied with the emperor, they'll get independence. They got French colonialism of Lebanon, Syria. They got British colonialism of Jordan, including Palestine, and, of course, Iraq. And the bombing of Iraq started in 1922, and it was done by Harris, the bomber. Harris, Ted Harris, famous later on, who used the Iraqi people to exercise with gas included. Now, Sykes-Picot, every Arab schoolchild I know those names. I find quite a lot of French and British who don't know it. The top dog can live very well with his crimes. It's the underdog who suffers them. 1917, the Balfour Declaration, after the introduction of colonialism. You can read it many ways, but you can also read it as establishing a home where the hosts had not extended invitation, but somebody who saw themselves fit to manage it. And this, of course, also has to do with Genesis 15 to 17, if that is a covenant between God and the Jews. Those who lived there might say that we didn't sign it. And it might have been a good idea if you had just shown us to us and given us a hearing. Instead, in Deuteronomy, it was explained in a very detailed way what's going to happen to you. Now, if we take that as a point of departure, you come up immediately, of course, with the first way out of the crisis. U.S. troops withdraw. But it's not that simple. Because in 1945, a treaty was signed between Franklin Roosevelt and Ibn Saud. It was signed on an aircraft carrier in the Suez Canal after the Yalta meeting by Roosevelt, who was extremely impressed with the role of oil in warfare. He wanted a permanent supply of oil in order to eternalize, I presume, U.S. victory, having had as a major strategy to cut the Germans and the Japanese off from oil resources, quite successfully so. His engineers had told him that Arabia had unlimited supply. Standard Oil had been working there since 1933. The treaty contained two essential clauses. Point one, unlimited U.S. access to extract the black gold. Point two, a promise by U.S. to protect the royal house against its opposition. Now, this was Wahhabite Saudi Arabia doing exactly the same things as the Taliban's have been accused of, but doing it at a higher level of economic income. What then happened yesterday or yesteryear was that the income goes down. And it's no longer possible for the royal house to bribe every single citizen. They also had to pay a hefty sum for U.S. protection during the Gulf War. You can say that the equation changed, but when 15 out of 19 Arabs from Saudi Arabia bombed two buildings, it's not obvious that the response is to kill 3,700 civilians in Afghanistan. You can say that doesn't fit, that's Al-Qaeda. All the Egyptian specialists I know are unanimous about one thing. Al-Qaeda is relatively horizontal. It's organized the same way as a guerrilla movement would be. And the operation in Afghanistan had three principal tasks, one of them admitted by New York Times yesterday, or the day before yesterday, to support the Taliban in the fight against the Northern Alliance. The other two theaters were, of course, Kashmir and Chechnya. The Russians and the Indians are infinitely grateful to the U.S. for what happened. But the war was a fiasco. The war was a fiasco. George Bush has a scorecard in his office with 22 faces on it that they have decided are the Al-Qaeda leadership. He has crossed out six of them. Six out of 22 is 23%, very poor score. The two top ones, nowhere to be found. Of course, you can continue killing, and you can say that we killed more leaders. They must have appointed an enormous amount of leaders, because the killing is extensive, according to what they say. So what happened then? It's probably that they relieved India and Russia of pressure, and at the same time paved the ground for what they wanted to do, a military base in India, in Afghanistan, and access for UNOCAL for the two pipelines. Now, about this, there are two points to be said. The first is, we start on the assumption that somebody had something against U.S. capitalism and U.S. militarism. Whereupon you do a lot of killing and a lot of bombing, and how does it end up? You establish U.S. militarism and U.S. capitalism. Now, if your enemy has an image of you as doing that, you have confirmed his image. You can do nothing more stupid than confirm the image your enemy has of you. Imagine you did the opposite. You would confuse him. Now, this is Chinese warfare. It's not US. You will find it in Sun Tzu. And you'll find exactly the idea that you escape from the mental grid that he has thrown on you. And in doing so, you make a chance of breaking out of the paradigm by breaking his paradigm down. The CIA made a study of Saudi Arabian youth after the war in Afghanistan, after the first declaration that the war was over. I can tell you a secret. That war will last about 100 years. There will be many declarations that it is over. Many. And they will all be proven untrue. Now, the study was to inquire into Saudi Arabian youth where they stood on Al-Qaeda. 95% were positive. I don't call that an astounding success. It is rather using a strange type of antibiotic where you kill some bacteria in the middle of the attack, but that antibiotic converts into feeding the rest of them so that the other bacteria are just procreating delightfully and deliciously. I don't think it's wise policy. Can they withdraw from Saudi Arabia? Well, there's one excuse they cannot use. They cannot say that we are not in Mecca and Medina, we are elsewhere. The Wahhabite idea is that Arabia is the sacred land, all of it, the land of the two cities. And when Wahhab died, one of his last words was that let there be no two religions in this sacred land. If they withdraw, they have to pay a price. The price is probably the collapse of the royal house. The royal house knows this. And that's the reason why they are up in front of the US in what to my mind is an excellent peace plan, or element of a peace plan. Total recognition of Israel, deep recognition, in return from Israel vacating the occupied territories. I'm not so sure that it is for love of Palestinians. Maybe for enlightened self-love. But if it is a move in the right direction, it's a good move. The US should embrace it, the UK should embrace it. They should embrace it and they should understand that it's only along these lines they can ever hope to reduce the hatred against them and those who are avenging on behalf of Allah. I'd like to spend one more minute on that one. And I would like to just introduce you to the organization Transcend. I'm the director of it. One co-director is Kai Fritjof Blind Jacobsen, who is sitting there. www.transcend.org. All you have to remember is that Transcend, go beyond, and it is an organization, and you have it. And you'll find fascinating reading. You'll also find a fascinating book called Searching for Peace, second edition, just coming by Pluto Press. It's almost sold out already, so be quick. Now, having said that, the the point about the Middle East is that one can go one step further. There was once a hated country in Europe called Germany. What do we do about it? Five neighboring countries, after much hesitation, much difficulty, from 1967 on, but before that from 1958, 1st of January, established the European Community. In the first round, the European Economic Community, telling Germany, you are, and not only by location, one of us. You'll be in our family. We just give you two pieces of advice. Keep silent for 20 years and pay all the bills. La communauté européenne, pensez pour les Français, payez pour les Allemands. Okay. There's a hated country in the Middle East called Israel. It has five neighbors. Those neighbors could say the same. A Middle East community. They could also say, keep a little bit silent for some years and pay many of the bills. If you want the rich countries in the region, Iraq and Saudi Arabia, to pay the bills, you have to make them members. Are you sure you want that? Or could it be that Lebanon, Syria, Palestine as Benelux, Egypt as France, and Jordan as Italy might not be a bad choice? And maybe in that multilateral setting, Egypt and Jordan could contribute some square kilometers to Palestine to make it bigger on a lease basis for 99 years. It's more easily done in a multilateral setting. We don't need more proof of the two parties' inability to settle it bilaterally. To demand that they should go to the table and settle an impossible question bilaterally is inhuman. You might also say that two persons could retire, Sharon and Arafat, and that it is a task of U.S. to provide for them bungalows in Florida. Could be neighboring bungalows where they can continue. And if they come up with something, let's hear about it. Edward Said has an excellent list of candidates from the Palestinian side. Go to any major demonstration of peace now in Israel and you'll find a number of excellent names. I'm just indicating something. Break out of bilateralism, go to multilateralism. Decisions by consensus, let trade and tourism blossom. Try to sow cultural seeds. Show the Abrahamic religions on their most beautiful non-fundamentalist side. Don't ask anybody to mediate, and particularly not anybody big. Ask the technicians from European Community, Nordic Community, and ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, just to tell how you do it. The nitty-gritty of it. Well, having said that, we are left with a lot of things for US to do. US has to come to terms with Iraq together with UK. UK is still fighting 1922. Just like UK has been fighting quite a lot of former wars and going on. You have a vicious karma riding you. In 1841, UK was badly wounded when the invasion army was beaten. Everybody killed except for one who was permitted to go out of Afghanistan to tell the story. Well, the British are back again. And of course, they went immediately to the cemetery in Jalalabad. And of course, the trauma that had been haunting them was to some extent something they were released from. But the problem is that it's not so good to be run by countries with so many traumas. And the UK should engage in some self-psychiatry, psychoanalysis, and put itself on the couch before it engages in that kind of thing. Better would be just simply to invite the Iraqi leadership to an open dialogue. What are your problems? They had six problems in 1990. All those problems could have been negotiated. Saddam Hussein made a stupid criminal act. But that act was not without the same kind of precedent historically as UK to some extent is deriving nourishment from. The 19th province under the Ottoman Empire, Kuwait, having been extracted from the Iraqi part of the Ottoman Empire by whom? By the UK, the end of the 1890s, made into a darling because black gold had been found. Now, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission would have much work to do to try to handle that one. The way is not to bomb the country to pieces. The way is rather to have a dialogue, look at the concrete problems and find imaginative solutions for them. In fall 1990, the Saddam Hussein people came four times to Washington to ask for negotiations and were rebuffed all times. It's a rather important point. I'm not sure they cared to come to you people because maybe they went straighter, they wanted to be closer to God, suffering a little bit from the same idea themselves, so they know what they're talking about. Iran. Khatami, the president, issued an invitation for an open dialogue, and he wanted it as a dialogue of civilizations. The US said no. They were afraid it would be used for propaganda purposes, and it would have been used for what the US calls propaganda purposes. The US would have to suffer through 1961, 1973, 1978. They would have to hear all that. But then comes the strong US point. Okay, are you through? Now, where do we go from now? It's a good question. And one problem with the US is that they're so damn good at working out answers by rolling up the sleeves and having the boys working at it. Let me hope the Irani side is equally well prepared. You can say it is the tyranny of hard work. The tyranny of putting creative ideas there. It's a very strong US side. Having said that, I'm convinced that can be solved. But the dialogue has to be at the highest level and it has to be open, public. It's not enough with the UK foreign minister sneaking in, having some talks behind closed doors. It's not satisfactory. And that was exactly the reason why the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa was public, presided over by Tutu. And that's the reason why they put it on the SABC, the South African Broadcasting Corporation. And that's the reason why it worked. That doesn't mean that South Africa doesn't have other problems galore. Afghanistan. I was mediator in Afghanistan in February last year. Called in, not by governments, but by very strong Afghan forces. And I'll not go through the very, very complicated process we had. I'll just mention the five conclusions. And the conclusions were unanimous by 100 people, 30 of whom were what is called tribal leaders, sheikhs, 30 of whom were former cabinet members, 30 of whom were professors, not very useful as a matter of fact. There is something about professors that at least have to be recycled to some extent. 10 were women, the most useful people in the group. And I had to restrain myself not to praise them too much, more than the other 90 could take. So when I praised them, they said, The five conclusions were, point one, a coalition government with Talibans, not without Talibans. There are two percentages of Talibans we don't like, 100% which we have, 0% which we may get. They predicted a US attack. Talibans have something valuable. Point two, basic human needs as the guiding light for that government. Food, clothing, housing, health, education for all. Footnote, we are not convinced by universal human right in all cases. We think men and women are somewhat different, for which reason we talk about complementary human rights. You yourself do the same because you have a special declaration of human rights for women. Could we have a dialogue about it? And don't immediately assume that we say this because we want to repress women. No, this is the softer aspect. It exists, the harder aspect also exists. Next point, Afghanistan is a federation with elements of a Swiss constitution. We cannot continue on the myth of a country run by Pashtuns as a unitary state. Karzai is a Pashtun. Why does he talk such a good English? Because he was the Afghan consultant to UNOCAL on pipelines. Imposed from abroad. Now, federation. How do we relate, next point, to the neighboring countries? Community, a Central Asian community. With the five former Central Asian republics, Muslim of the Soviet Union, Iran, Pakistan, possibly whatever part of Kashmir would be in it. This is for the future, 20 years. Worth working for. How can we get all of this? Cooperating with the UN and the UN cooperating with the Organization of the Islamic Conference. We cannot accept UN the way it is today. It has a nucleus in the Security Council of five countries. Four of them are Christian, one of them is Confucian. And that Confucian country has a problem with the Muslim minority. There are 56 Islamic countries in the world. Would you accept a Security Council with four Muslim countries and China? We would not. It has to be tempered with the organization of the Islamic Conference. So there you have five ideas, and I just communicate them. They sound to me like good ideas. Every single one has been negated by the process initiated from the abroad. I don't leave that process any chance. Next point. There has to be reconciliation, and I stop with that one. I'll say a couple of words about reconciliation. Reconciliation is the method whereby you exit from retaliation cycles. And of course, the basic theory of this middle column is retaliation. September 11 happened, it was retaliation. The war on Afghanistan was retaliation. What is coming now will also be retaliation. And you can say they don't have much chance because whatever they concoct militarily will be stopped. Okay, let me give you one example. Economic boycott of US goods. You can do that without having any military means at your disposal. US won't like it. US is not in the most healthy economic situation. They might need a foreign trade they can get. Yet it's a rather obvious prediction. Reconciliation is based on many factors, but I'd just like to mention one. And I'd like to quote the master in reconciliation, and that is strangely enough not South Africa, it is Germany. Germany occupied 18 countries, one of them my own. They occupied only a part of UK, Guernsey, Jersey, and they met with quite a lot of nice cooperation, giving an interesting image of what occupied UK might have looked like, but I'm not going to develop that. Let me stick to the Channel Islands and be satisfied with that. But it has been very difficult for UK people to stomach that one. They tried to exterminate two nations, the Jews. Today they have reasonably good relations with all 20. How did they manage that? Actually, only 30 years afterwards. I think one of the last of the countries to hold out was Calvinist Netherlands, also a very moralistic country. The more fundamentalist you are, the less will you be inclined to reconcile. Was there a method to apologize? Yes, it was to apologize. Was it to pay compensation? Yes, it was, and I had sticky fingers with some of them. But that was not a crucial method. Crucial method was school textbooks. It was to write in the textbooks that we understand that we have done an unspeakable wrong. We will do everything not to do it again. And we feel this so strongly that we want to convey that image to the coming generation and the generation after that. I haven't seen that textbook so explicit in connection with what British imperialism did. I'm longing for it. It would be something akin to what the Americans called an industry if UK professors should try to write those textbooks. Will there be takers, not only givers? Oh, yes, there will. Will it be a part of the curriculum? No. But the best curriculum is always the textbook the good student brings and has on his or her knees under the desk. That's the best textbook. But Germany did it officially, publicly. Made an enormous impression. I could spin on that one and I could go further and I could say with a little story that the US has a long distance to go. Right after the war in the Vietnam, there were five photos in all US history textbooks, and you know them all five. I'll just quote a couple of them. The naked girl running away from a NAPAM attack on civilian population, who later on became a goodwill ambassador for UNESCO. Buddhist. Inspired. The police boss in Saigon executing a so-called Viet Cong. The people climbing up a ladder hanging from a helicopter from the roof of the embassy. The My Lai. All those pictures have disappeared. A US professor in 1990 made a study of his college students, how much they knew about the Vietnam War. And he asked the question, the Vietnam War was between ta-ta-ta-ta-ta and ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. So it was a fill-in test. The leading answer by 22% was the Vietnam War was between North Korea and South Korea. He said, that's wrong. The Vietnam War was not between North Korea and South Korea. I give you an F. One of the students complained to the administration and said, I merit at least a D because I got North and South correct. That I call imaginative legal talent. I mean, we have a coming lawyer coming there. I choose to stop at that point. Ladies and gentlemen, we have work to do. Thank you. I'll tell you one thing. If you continue like that, I'll give the talk once again. So stop now.
Well, I think the clapping showed how much people appreciated your usual sparkling talk. But we have about 20 minutes for questions. So who would like to ask a question? There are roving mics. The lady just there. And it'd be nice if you said your name and where you're from so we get an idea of who you are.
Juliana,
your social security number, please, or FBI identification.
Juliana Yochan, I work for a Palestinian NGO in Ramallah. I want your comments about the prospects of this war against Iraq that's coming up.
It's extremely high, and I think it has to do with excessive unprocessed trauma in US and UK. The idea of having been snubbed and the idea of Iraq being uppity. UK has much more experience. It has been more uppity to the US than to the UK, but it has lasted longer for the UK. You can then argue that the generation that did a bombing in 1922 is dead. But you see, the things live on. And they live on as the idea of the Iraq is being wicked and deserving a good beating. And this is then, of course, wrapped up in what is so dear to the Western mind, the identification of Satan. And Satan is pulling all the lines and has all the command. And I must say that Bin Laden contributed considerably to that image by speaking out of a cave, which is exactly where Satan is supposed to be located. So I can see the whole Southern Baptist gang sitting in front of the television nodding. Exactly. That's what we said. I'm afraid that the prospects are very bad. That makes it even more important that governments speak up and that non-governments speak up. Now, there's a public opinion poll in Britain which showed, as was reported today in The Guardian, the voters are against. Let's see what happens.
The person at the back there.
My name is Manoubi Akrut. I am a journalist from Tunisia. In fact, Professor, I have almost 40 questions to ask you, but I'll ask only three or four.
Could you just ask one, please? Because there are so many people here wanting to ask questions.
I need only very short answers. The first thing is Mrs. Thatcher have attacked Europe in the Today or Yesterday issue of The Times. What do you think about the avenir of Europe? The second thing, which future do you see in Palestine? Will there be really a reconciliation, in your opinion? Third thing, in Pakistan, which future for this country, which is Muslim and nuclear? This, will it be allowed? The last thing, What do you see in Mr. Arafat in the special position that he occupies now? Thank you very much.
The last one I didn't get. Sorry, if you could just repeat the last one. I'm not going to...
The last one? Yeah. Yes, your opinion about Mr. Arafat, the leader, the Palestinian leader.
Now, the last one I sort of indicated, I think, retirement. And you say, I mean, the point is this, and I think it applies to all of us, that you are useful up to a certain point. And there is a point where your message becomes repetitive. And you have to simply look for people who can have somewhat different messages. Now, I have an enormous admiration for him, and I think it is fantastic that he has kept out. And yet, I say what I say. When it comes to Pakistan, it is a victim that has been clutched in the claws of this. And it doesn't bode too well for Pakistan, particularly when the hunting for Al-Qaeda will go on inside Pakistan, which is probably what will happen. And at that point, a civil war will probably be unavoidable. When it comes to the first question, I could say it's outside the topic, but I'll first correct you. What Madame Thatcher said was not about Europe, it was about the European Union. Europe has 53 countries, 15 of them are members of the European Union. One of them, a non-member, is my country, and we refuse to have that organization referred to as Europe. Let us keep the concepts clear. Now, she wants to exit from it, and she's been wanting that for a long time. I think she does it for the wrong reasons. I myself am against Norwegian membership, because I'm afraid it becomes a superpower, and I'm afraid that the only thing they have against the U.S. is that the U.S. does what they want to do. Now, you can say that's paranoid. I can then give a one-semester course of why it is not paranoid, or only localized paranoia, limited paranoia, and so on. But what she is saying is that the reason why we are against it is that from continent came all the evils, namely Nazism and Marxism. She leaves out her own evil, which was considerable. You can say that it didn't touch. You have to go back to the Rose Wars and things like that in order to find some real evil exercised in Europe. But it touched the rest of the world. And I can just conjure on the wall an image of something which would have been terribly useful. If you go back to 1997 and you get the changes of the flags in Hong Kong, if Prince Charles had used that occasion to apologize for the gunboat diplomacy, for the opium wars, for Jardine Matheson being the ones who showed the gunboats where to go, and things of that kind. He would have won about, at that time, 1.1 billion customers. He might have lost his kingdom. But by British rationality, I think 1.1 billion customers is even better than a monarchy. Bad choice.
Now, what I'm going to do is, I think, because of time, I'm going to take several questions, if that's okay.
The problem is the answer, I know.
We have precisely 10 minutes, and I can see how many hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So you all have to have 1 minute each. And I'll just go around the room. So I start with you.
On Afghanistan, I'm very glad you're a mediator. In February, I think you're referring to this year, because I would say,
Last year.
Was that during the Taliban rule? My question is, I'm sympathetic to revolutionary movements in the Middle East and Palestinians, but I never liked the Taliban because of their treatment of women. So I think that some progress them having gone, but I'd like your comment.
They may not like you either.
Okay, Scott.
Hi, first I'd thank you and say very inspiring, and I really appreciate that. My question is, with the current militaristic culture in the United States, with the culture of militarism in the United States and this good versus evil language that is going on, do you think reconciliation is possible? And if so, how do people like me influence my government to do that?
Okay, down here, Kai. Here, down here.
It continues a bit on the last one. The U.S. ambassador in Whitehall is about to lead this country into another war. And I was wondering, according to the title of the lecture, if you could speak a little bit on what can be done by students, civil society organizations, people, professors, people in the community here to mobilize for peace and to oppose what is a very, as you said, evangelical and militarist regime in England.
Okay. Gentleman there and the gentleman at the back.
Shraib Sharifi, an Afghan journalist who came from Afghanistan yesterday and may leave tomorrow. The conference is seeking for peace after September the 11th, but we have been seeking for peace over 2 decades. Does the professor think that we are about to reach our goal, or are we about to survive, or what do you consider the status and the destiny of the Afghans after the September the 11th?
Okay, person just here.
How do you feel that the inevitable running out of what you refer to as black gold oil, how will that actually affect the field in terms of the political situation within that entire region?
Yes, that person, yeah.
I'm just wondering what you think the prospects are in Southern Africa, given this ongoing struggle between black nationalists and America and the UK meddling in Southern Africa piously. What's the future for whites generally in Southern Africa, given this, you know, uneasy relationship that will get worse?
Now down here.
You mentioned that you don't like. You mentioned that you don't like the prospect of the European Union becoming a superpower. In my assessment, one of the reasons that the world we live has become a more dangerous place now than it was before 1989 is because of the destruction of the balance between the United States and the Soviet Union. In this respect, if in the ascent of the European Union one can see some kind of equilibrium, not necessarily in the military sense, between some people who have a better sense of proportion than the present Bush administration, why do you think that this is not a welcome development?
Now, were there any others? There was one up there, so that this is the last. The lady up there.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this irreverent and refreshing talk that falls out of the norm. I'm wondering if you got directly involved in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and if so, if you could briefly comment on who invited you and how this went about. Thank you. There was another hand down here.
I think we've run out of time if we want a proper answer, I'm afraid.
Thank you so much for fascinating questions, and I'll try to react to all of them. Yes, the Taliban's treated the women abominably. Their excuse was that after 23 years of warfare, you had an enormous amount of bad men rowing around in the streets. They did not have the police to protect the women, hence they admonished and partly forced the women to stay at home. We had, practically speaking, all the schools destroyed. They gave priority to schools for boys. But that was not to be their program in the longer run. Now, you may accept or not accept that. I know Talibans, and I think most people in this room have never seen the Taliban. They have read much about them. I share what is said about Talibans, but everything that's said about Talibans can also be said about Saudi Arabia. So if you're against them, please turn against Saudi Arabia. And if you want to bomb, and you think bombing is the approach, start bombing tomorrow. Just start. Go ahead. Yeah? Because that was the Bush-Blair excuse, you see, that we didn't get Bin Laden, we didn't get Mullah Omar, but we got rid of the Taliban regime. It is genuinely Wahhabite. And that's where it comes from. So when I made the quip that the Talibans may not like you either, what I tried to say was the Taliban's very intolerant, very moralistic, extremely moralistic. I can tell you a mini anecdote. I went up to the 10 ladies in that conference, the mediation workshop, and said to the ladies, you've had lunch, but you have not said prayers. The ladies said, as you know, sir, from the Quran, men are not supposed to be present when we say prayers. You are a man. First of all, we did say prayers. Second, you can only get that information on the basis of breaking the Quran. Well, that's a rather clever answer. The Taliban disappeared. So you can learn much from it. An unenlightened moralism that then was encountered by very firm, sharp, well-trained women. There were 10 of them. You could have said it would have been better if it had been 50. It would have been better if it had been 50. But those 10 were absolutely brilliant. And it was not zero. Now, the cult of militarism in the US, it's tough. And it's an extremely hard nut to crack. And I sympathize with you. You will not get the U.S. government with you, but you can have wonderful Americans with you doing it. They can start rewriting those textbooks. I mean, you know one author who has done it, Howard Zinn. And Howard Zinn changed for millions how they view U.S. history. You can do things of that type. For heaven's sake, don't wait for the government to do it. I'm sometimes asked whether I'm anti-American. Not at all. I love it. I love the place. But I don't like U.S. foreign policy, and that's perhaps made relatively clear. I despise it and I hate it. I find it fascist, unabashedly fascist. There are two alternative explanations of the data I put. Namely, that this was all to protect democracy and human rights. Well, if that was the case, they would have bombed Somoza and not the Sandinistas, indirectly. They would have bombed Duvalier and not tried to make hell for Aristide. They would have made their choices differently. They would not have been behind the bombing of the other 11 September. The hypothesis falls in light of the data. The second hypothesis, it's war of civilizations, nonsense. In a very bad book, which is not about civilizations at all, you find no civilization analysis in that book. If that had been the point, they would have bombed mosques. They would have gone at the symbols of the Islamic civilization. I find no mosque bombing. What I find as the common denominator of all those is a very simple factor, class conflict, to maintain status quo and eternalize it. Class between countries and class between people inside countries, and particularly when they are combined. And I can take every one of the 67 or the 233 since 1804, which was the first one under Thomas Jefferson, can take every one and show it is compatible with that hypothesis. There are a couple little bit strange ones, but you might have to permit for some mistakes. What can be done? What can be done is a strong movement, Islamic movement, against their fundamentalists, and a strong Western movement against ours. Expose them. The futility of their way of thinking. How they feed into each other. How the rest of us are kept hostage. There would be one movement for nonviolent approaches in the Islamic world and one in the Western world. Those movements are coming. Right now I see it more explicit in the Islamic world. You could have a Chandra Muzaffar in Kuala Lumpur in his movement for a just world doing miracles. You find in Egypt the same. You find Ali Mazrui in the United States trying now, working on a new Islamic university in the United States for what I would call the soft Islam. I mean, these things should be brought up as much as possible. Much work can be done in UK, some of it governmental. Outside UK, US, the Anglo-Saxon nucleus is tough. The solid element of Anglo-Saxon self-righteousness, which is at work. If you're now opposed to that, and here governments in Europe come up, and they come up, the Belgian government, the French, rumors among the Italians, you find splits and division, as I mentioned, in the UK cabinet, there are things coming. The person next to me, Mary, was extremely instrumental and important during the Cold War in mobilizing reason against the madness of the Baroque arsenal of weapons. And what happened, which was a decisive event, was that in 1984, the anti-nuclear movement of the West and the dissident movement of the East came together. The dissident movement stood for human rights. The anti-nuclear movement was against the nuclear arms race and stood for other things. And what was the joint slogan? Nuclear disarmament with human rights. Not so fantastically problematic. Made a lot of difference. It encouraged both of them. We had to work for a communality, sort of the movements coming together. Now, if you think that's far away, the Cold War started officially, in a sense, in 1949 or 48. This movement was in 1984. We cannot waste that much time. But we learned from what happened. So, Islamic and West together, government and non-government together, there will be a hard, solid nucleus of UK-US self-righteousness. But they're not running the world alone. I predicted the coming of this kind of opposition on September 12th, and it was called madness, and by my friends, slightly optimistic, it was. But it's only by saying it that such things come into being. On that day in the evening, I had a discussion on Austrian television with the American ambassador. And he said a thing which I understand, and I take it seriously. He said, by mentioning hypothetical US interventions, they are rather real as a matter of fact, but he called them hypothetical, you are justifying what they did. No, I'm not justifying, I'm explaining. If I mention, let us say, the Versailles Treaty as a partial explanation of Hitler, I'm not justifying what Hitler did. But I am indicating how maybe the Second World War could have been avoided by revising the Versailles Treaty. It didn't happen because of US-UK French self-righteousness. It was proposed. And it has something to do with being chosen nations, being close to God, being close to those close to God. At that time, UK was more sure of itself. It was not second-rate chosen, it was first-rate chosen. And US derived some chosenness from having been colonized and thereby blessed by you. And in addition, having arisen from you, thereby showing good puberty talent and things of that kind. Now, you can say all of this can be played upon. And I think it's important to expose the lies. And if Harry Pinter could please write a play about chosen countries, I would be very grateful. He's the one to do it. Use plays, use all methods, non-violent. Afghans after September 11, you have been used. You have been used exactly the same way you have been used before. You have been used, you have been imposed upon, you have been encroached upon. Can you be blamed for under the Taliban to have housed Al-Qaeda? Talibans can be blamed, but not for attacking the West. The West was not their primary goal. I think one has to have a little look at the environment and pay attention to the fact that the Muslims are in a dangerous, precarious situation in Russia, in China, in India. In Kashmir, it is not strange if Muslim youth feel called upon. Not strange. To call that an attack against the West is wrong. There was also an attack against the West. And one frightening hypothesis is that the 19 authors of that attack died with the attack. The German expression is Selbstaufhebung, the act that annihilates itself by eliminating the traces. It is perfectly possible for 19 people to organize that. All you need is a couple of money for a couple of first-class tickets and a couple of box openers. That's all you need. And in addition to that, hatred, feeling chosen. I am the messenger who will carry the sword. I fully understand that they are cheating with the translation of the diaries they found by publishing only a part of it, as has been revealed recently. Oil. It would help enormously if we could argue in favor of alternatives to fossil fuel. There are good ecological reasons and there are good political reasons for it. Just see to it that those alternatives are equally available all over the world. Whether it is hydrogen oxygen synthesis, solar energy, or what it is. Under solar energy, UK would be at a loss, being essentially a relatively foggy place, which probably explains some of the imperialism. They just wanted to get into the sun, these people. That's why they wanted. Exactly, that's very good. Get them going, keep them up, make them high and tall. Exactly, keep them up, mobilize them. South Africa, I will not engage in crystal ball gazing on that one. I'll not do that, but I'll say a couple of words about EU as a superpower. Yes, there is a point to what you said. There is a point of being the balancing against them, but in that case, they would have to have a more clear policy. You see, imagine now that the European Union had come out from the very beginning saying, not the French arrogant word, your analysis is simplistic, so simplicist, Monsieur Bush. I mean, that's not the way to say it. You have to put forward an alternative policy. And the alternative policy would have been along the lines that I was just saying now, something like that, something of that type. That would have been a blessing. Now, they didn't do that. And you can also say that the U.S. has a Trojan horse inside the European Union called NATO. Precisely. You can say that it is the old story again. It's the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So the Father sits in Washington, the Son sits in London and looks youthful, and the Holy Connecting Spirit is NATO. So if you run it according to that one, you need a strong Pentecostal movement or something of the kind to stand up against it. Brethren, Mennonites, Quakers. So Quakers from Bradford unite, I mean, things of that kind. But you need more than Bradford. In other words, what I'm afraid of is what I read in the European Union, a kind of joint, let us say you have 11 dilapidated colonialism. You have former retired eagles and dilapidated lions, things of that kind. And you put them all together under the assumption that that would produce a lamb. Now, that's a biology I don't believe in. Maybe I'm too skeptical. If you could evoke the sheepishness in dilapidated lions, it would be fine. Would be fine. I'll join you immediately. Last point, who invited me? Well, one of the rules of the game is you don't talk about names, you see. I can only tell you that there are hundreds and hundreds of dialogues behind what I'm saying. High up, low down, sidewards, upwards, backwards, and above all, forwards. The methodology that we use is to ask people in a conflict, tell us a little bit about the Middle East you would like to live in.
What?
Middle East like to live in? Yes, dream. Conjure an image on the wall. Jake Lynch, our leading guy on peace journalism, and I, we conducted a workshop in Amman in Jordan some years ago, and we did exactly that. And I'll only tell you a one-liner. A Jordanian journalist who said, I want to have my breakfast at Tiberias, northern Israel, my lunch in Jericho, and my nightlife in Aqaba. Now, his BMW looked promising. He had a good, decent sheikh as a father. But the roads are not quite up to the BMW, so you need a multilateral setting to improve the roads. Thank you.